out of copyright, out of mind, some poetry. It seems that a question that frequently comes up is, can anyone recommend some good pre-Tolkien fantasy? When this question arises, the usual suspects are then wheeled out. Edison's The Worm Ouroboros, or anything by Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, Mervyn Peake, or Dunsany. Usually Paul Anderson, Hope Merlies, Fritz Lieber, and Clark Ashton Smith get a mention too. I thought it might be an interesting exercise to read and discuss some pre-Tolkien fantasy writers that don't get mentioned as often. In particular, I thought I might focus on some out-of-copyright short stories. The plan is to record the short story as an audio file, then discuss it, but for my first outing, I thought I'd start with something a little bit different, poetry. And I've probably lost about half of you, but anyway, for those who remain, I've selected 5 poems. I considered others, including works by William Blake and William Morris, but kept coming back to these. My criteria was 1, short enough to listen to quickly, and 2, sufficiently fantasy-ish that the work can be at least argued to have influenced later fantasy writers. I won't labour each discussion, just a quick note on why I think each work is interesting and how I think it might have influenced things, even if perhaps indirectly. I'm going to start off with a bit of Keats, because why not? Now, I'm also going to warn you here that this is a fairly raw recording. If I make a mistake, I'm just going to correct myself and keep going. I won't be doing a lot of editing here. I have recorded each poem separately as well, and those recordings are a tiny bit more polished. So, Keats. La Belle Dame Sans Merci, a ballad by John Keats. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woebegone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest done. I see a lily on thy brow, with anguish moist and fever dew, and on thy cheeks a fading rose, fast withereth too. I met a lady in the meads, full beautiful, a fairy's child. Her hair was long, her foot was light, and her eyes were wild. I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrant zone. She looked at me, as she did love, and made sweet moan. I set her on my pacing steed, and nothing else saw all that day, for sidelong she would she bend and sing a fairy song. She found me roots of relish sweet, and honey wild, and manna dew. And sure in language strange she said, I love thee true. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore, and there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses four. And there she lulled me asleep, and there I dreamed in woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamt on the cold hillside. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, deaf pale were they all. They cried, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, thee hath in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam, with horrid warning gaped wide, and I awoke and found me here, on the cold hillside. And this is why I sojourn here, alone and palely loitering, though the sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. The perilous fantasy enchantress has long been a staple of European tradition, from Arthurian stories to Spanish romances. Here we have a beautifully imagined moment of a man ensnared. He knows that he is doomed to become one of the pale ghosts, but cannot move himself from the fairy hill. For influence, the beauty without mercy certainly echoes across various fantasy works where fairies are beautiful, dangerous, and powerful. I suspect that some modern urban fantasy writers may owe something to Keats, though likely via a twisted descent. The path probably runs through other authors. I'm thinking of Paul Anderson's Water Nixie in Three Hearts and Three Lions, or Howard's Frost Giant's Daughter. The motif is so common and so broad that it's impossible to say how much influence Keats had with this particular poem, and how much might be simply an inheritance of folklore and tradition. In the end, this poem is possibly best viewed as a good example of a very well-trodden trope. On a couple more specific points, I do suspect that Tolkien's representation of elf maids was likely influenced by the depiction here, especially the trope of meeting a fair elf woman in the wilds and falling immediately in love. I wonder also if the invisible rose that appears over a fairy-charmed mouth in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is an echo of the lily and the rose in this poem. Certainly the sad false revelry of fairy in both Jonathan Strange and The Ladies of Grace to Dew. seems to be a revivation of Keats, though, again, this is not a notion unique to Keats. Catherine Briggs argues quite convincingly that Faerie was traditionally viewed as a land of the dead, and its seeming revelries were fragile and false. Clarke has cited Briggs's Faerie Dictionary as a key influence. The Kraken by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Below the thunders of the upper deep, far, far beneath in the abysmal sea, his ancient dreamless uninvaded sleep, the Kraken sleepeth, faintest sunlights flee. About his shadowy sides, above him swell huge sponges of millennial growth and height, and far away into the sickly light, from many a wondrous grot and secret cell, unnumbered and enormous polyp high, winnow with giant arms the slumbering green, their happy lane in ages, and will lie, battening upon huge sea worms in his sleep, until the latter fire shall heat the deep, then once my man and angels to be seen, and roaring he shall rise, and on the surface die. Okay, so who doesn't immediately think of Lovecraft? I'm not the first to point out that Tennyson's The Kraken feels strongly like a proto-Lovecraftian poem. As far as we know, however, there is no evidence that Lovecraft ever read The Kraken. But given Lovecraft's enthusiasm for poetry and given the general popularity of Tennyson, it seems implausible that this poem didn't cross Lovecraft's reading list at some point. That's mostly it for The Kraken. The poem probably has an influence on other writers too, though when it comes to slumbering sea monsters, H.P. Lovecraft himself will have had a far greater and more direct influence. I want to move on to goblins now. The Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti. Now here I'm breaking my rule about keeping the poems short. This poem is too long to paste into the body of a post, but you can read it via the link above or listen to it if you prefer. I'm going to read out only the first stanza in the full audio of me nattering away. Morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry, come buy our orchard fruits, come buy apples and quinces, lemons and oranges, plump unpicked cherries, melons and raspberries, bloom down cheeked peaches, swart-headed mulberries, wild freeborn cranberries, crab apples, dewberries, pineapples, blackberries, apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather, morns it pass by, fair eves it fly, come buy, our grapes fresh from the vine, pomegranates full and fine, dates and sharp belaces, rare pears and gringaces, damsons and bilberries, taste them and try, currants and gooseberries, bright fire like barberries, figs to fill your mouth, citrons from the south, sweet to tongue and sound to eye, come buy. I wanted to include the Goblin Market because the idea of a dangerous, magical goblin creatures plying a trade in strange, dangerous goods has echoed down through stories. And I suspect it is mostly due to this one poem. Light in the Mist obviously owes something to the notion of addictive and dangerous fairy fruits. Obviously, also simply eating food in fairy is itself a mortal danger. Christina was working from a tradition too. But I wonder also how much the Froudian goblins of the Labyrinth owe to the shambling, animal-faced and weird goblins of Christina Rossetti. There are perilous fairy markets in Neil Gaiman's writing. I'm thinking in particular of the Books of Magic and also Stardust. A fairy market appears in Hellboy at least once, if I remember right, or was that only in one of the movies? Anyway, I lose track. There is something like a modernized version of a fairy market in the rivers of London too. It's all over the place, really. So much so that the fairy market is now infringing on the boundaries of the cliched. However, interestingly, the theme of a dangerous fairy market doesn't really seem to occur in folklore, or in stories before Christina Rossetti. As far as I can determine, this one poem is more or less solely responsible for this particular trope. That is something of an accomplishment. It's also worth noting that the dangers of eating fairy food in fairyland traditionally don't really seem to encompass fruit specifically. It's food more generally. And in stories where someone does eat fairy food, it tends to be bread or a feast or something quite random. So the Rossetti family, incidentally, were well known as eccentric intellectuals at their time. The risque sexual elements of the poem probably owe something to a liberally minded family in which a woman felt free to write such stuff. They were a curious bunch on the whole, the Rossettis, Christina's brother had a pet wombat, and it is very likely that England narrowly avoided a feral wombat infestation when the wombat's intended mate died at sea mid-transport. A wombatish goblin appears in the Goblin Market, and Lewis Carroll, who we shall come back to, originally wrote a wombat into the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, basing it on the Rossetti's rather sleepy and indolent pet wombat. His publisher thought it too obscure an animal, so he changed it to a dormouse. Enough trivia. Let's move on to another changeling story, but this one a bit shorter. So The Fairies by William Allingham. Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen, we daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men. We folk, good folk, trooping all together, green jacket, red cap, and a white owl's feather. Down along the rocky shore, some make their home. They live on crispy pancakes of yellow-tide foam. Some in the reeds of the black mountain lake, with frogs for their watchdogs all night awake. High on the hilltop the old king sits, he is now so old and grey, he's nigh lost his wits. With a bridge of white mist Colin Kelly crosses, on his stately journeys from Sleolik to Rosses. Or going up with the music on cold starry nights, to sup with the queen of the gay northern lights. They stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone. They took her lightly back between the night and morrow. They thought that she was fast asleep, but she was dead with sorrow. They have kept her ever since deep within the lake, on a bed of fig leaves, watching till she wake. By the craggy hillside, through the mosses bare, they have planted thorn trees for my pleasure here and there. Is any man so daring as dig them up in spite? He shall find their sharpest thorns in his bed at night. Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen, we daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men. We folk, good folk, trooping all together, green jacket, red cap, and a white owl's feather. The Fairies by William Allingham is one of the better-known fantastical poems that doesn't seem to have contributed as much to modern fantasy. It's actually a very good summary of folkloric beliefs around fairies, but a lot of these beliefs don't seem to have transitioned very fully into modern stories. And even where a particular motif has slipped through, it's hard to know if old lost kings in Elfland or fairies not understanding the difference between death and sleep or the keeping of weird frogs as guards might have started here or there or somewhere else. These sort of elements occur a lot in a lot of stories. It's worth noting that Allingham also wrote a poem about the processions of the dead and phantoms of the soon-to-be dead that supposedly might be spied upon outside of churches on certain nights of the year. That poem, The Dream, isn't as well known as poetry goes, but it is also a very fine little supernatural poem and worth looking up if you like Allingham's poetical style. So I can't trace much to The Fairies, beside the odd snippet in the odd book. It is often quoted, especially that bit about how we daren't go a-hunting. So why did I include it? Well, it's just a very nice little poem, and getting enough into the fantastical rather than, say, the strictly folkloric, to qualify. I suspect that there are influences that I'm simply unaware of. Others may be able to chime in. And now on to the last poem I wanted to cover. I mentioned Lewis Carroll earlier, so this should be no surprise. Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. 'Twas brillig, and the slivy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe, or mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the manxome foe he sought. So rested he by the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1-2, 1-2, and through, the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. Mo frabjous jay de kalu kalay, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slivy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe. I wanted to include Jabberwocky for several reasons. One is that this is probably the closest we come in short fantastical poetry to an epic structure, where a hero strikes forth, confronts and overcomes something monstrous or evil, and then returns home. That the poem takes barely a minute to recite makes one wonder about the length of some modern epic works, perhaps. Ah, well. I think the other thing that is important and worth noting about Jabberwocky, and maybe all of Lewis Carroll's work, is that it has all very likely formed a pretty strong bedrock for the fantastical, dry, humorous works of a British bent. By this I mean Terry Pratchett, Douglas Adams, and others who write in that wry, tongue-in-cheek style. They are often pretending to be a bit foolish, but it's all a very clever trick. There's a lot of wisdom in Pratchett and Adams both, and Carroll very much seems to be one of the original voices in that vein, the wise fool quietly advising the reader how best to navigate a mad world. Obviously, Carroll alone did not invent this mode of humour. You can look to other authors like Jonathan Swift and find similar offbeat, half-serious, half-foolish fantasies. But I do think that Carroll probably did a lot to make this fantastical wise nonsense into something accessible for children, and that probably contributed to a lot of its entrenchment in British culture. It probably isn't a coincidence that members of the Monty Python crew did have a go at a film adaptation of Jabberwocky. Curiously, I do think the same vein of fantastical wise fool humour was evident among American writers at one point. Both Mark Twain and Frank Baum come to mind, even Thorne Smith perhaps. It seems to be eased off a little as a mode of humour in American writing, though obviously it is still going strong in the UK. So that's my little walkthrough of some fantasy poetry before Tolkien. You might have other suggestions to read, or you might think I've missed something important while including something trivial. I'll do my best to respond to comments and thoughts that you may have.